Thank you for inviting me back. It's good. It's been a crazy year for us. It's been an amazing summer in some respects. I'm going back to school. You know, we're going back to school starting in a couple of days, and it may seem restful at first. We had one son and got married last September. Actually, it'd be a year ago tomorrow. He got married, right? A year ago tomorrow? Yeah, September 3rd. And that was number one. And then, like, you know, when you got all these adult kids and in relationship, it's like the domino effect, right? And so just before he got married, just before Jaden and Haley got married, out at Nest, as a matter of fact, Jenkin and Janine, Jaden's twin brother, Jenkin, and his then girlfriend, then fiance, now his wife, Janine, they got married June 9th. They got engaged just before Jaden got married. I think he got married on June 9th. And then just before Jenkin and Janine got married, our eldest daughter, Caitlin, let us know that she was engaged, and she's going to get married August 18th. So we had three weddings in less than 12 months. Busy time. We had a few other weddings that we went to, right? Dan, you were officiating at one of those amongst the wasps and the bright sun. That was a fun time. Cassidy graduated from high school. That was our seventh born. And Jewel, who finished off most of her program. I can't remember what it's called, but she finished most of her program at CNC and then found out she got hired at Cedars. So, you know, we graduate them from Cedars and then we bring them back and we start to take over. You know, we got three of us now on staff at Cedars. My wife is an EA, and as Dan said, I'm a teacher. It's my fourth year there, and every year it's something different. Every year I got a course I've never done before. I take pictures, but I'm doing photojournalism, and Brooklyn and I were talking about it earlier because we're going to be doing the yearbook, you know? And then we're going to be hosting the Senior A Boys Provincial Volleyball Championships in November. I have never done that before, right? Hosting a big event like that. And then I get the joy of leading grad this year and organizing graduation. I don't know what's going to happen next year. You know, there's not much else left to do at that school. But it is a new year at school. And I expect for you, it's also, it's interesting, September's like a startup time as well for churches, right? Sort of you have this hiatus in the summertime where you don't do a whole lot. Well, at least you don't do as much. You know, you say don't do a whole lot. That sort of diminishes life between June and August. But, you know, new things start up, right? You get programs that begin again. And I know at our church, at Central Fellowship, we are, it's kickoff Sunday next week. And, you know, so everything starts, it's new and it's fresh in these projects. And I know, even when I was speaking at other churches, you know, people are looking for volunteers, people to step in and step up into certain roles that are vacant. Our church has got quite a few highlighted things where people need to, we'd love to have people step into roles and to lead and assist in different ways. And I expect in some respects, that might be the case here too. You're looking for people to do Sunday school classes or get involved in various ministries around the church. And as you can see, the title of this message is All for One, and you're already filling it in your head, right? I don't even have to put the words up there, right? You know, it's little trivia. Where does that phrase come from? Three Musketeers. There you go. Okay, good. Yeah, All for One and One for All. And it's an interesting scenario here. We appreciated Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 11 to 18 being read because it sort of sets the stage a little bit, right? It sets the situation that we have. Nehemiah is a cupbearer to the king of Persia, and his heart is burdened when he hears the state of things back in Jerusalem. The people have begun to return. The 70-year exile is effectively over. Now, the dates on the exile sometimes vary depending on what scholars you read. It's often based upon the first exile under Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, around 607 BC, and then the first return around 538 with Zerubbabel, or it's based on the last of the three exiles of the people of Judah under Nebuchadnezzar, when after some unrest for about 20 years, he finally sort of has enough, and the city of Jerusalem is destroyed, the walls are destroyed, the temple is destroyed, all of the valuables are taken off to Babylon, and then the temple is rebuilt finished around 515 BC. So you get these two different dates, but roughly you get 70 years for either of them. So they both work, and it's really irrelevant in some respects, but we do know that God had said that as much as the people were in anguish over being exiled, God did say, there's a reason for this, and it's going to last so long, and then you'll return. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't really get that sense that it's going to end sometime. And I expect some people actually probably went into exile never to return, right? Over 70 years, a lot of people would have died during that time. And perhaps it's the next generation or two that's going to experience the return. And we do have a return. The people of God have come home, the first of all in 538 BC under Zerubbabel, then 458 under the Ezra, and finally 445 under the leadership of Nehemiah. They come back, and there's different purposes for coming back. The first group comes back to rebuild the temple, and then that second group returns under Ezra, and then we have the third group coming back, and Nehemiah is passionate about seeing God's city restored. The walls around the city have not been rebuilt. The temple has been, and the temple to Israel, to the Jews in particular, most likely was a real sense of identity, right? That their identity was wrapped up around that particular building, which destroyed. They're scattered. They forget their identity really is found in God and God alone, but for them, the temple was key. But the walls had not been rebuilt, and Nehemiah saw that as the job that needed to be done, and he was inspired to do that. And I got a few pictures here just to sort of give you some sort of visual. This first picture is not anywhere around Jerusalem. It is somewhere in the Middle East. I forgot to find out where it was. But you can see the crumbled walls. You see the city gates. There are no actual gates there, but it's an opening in. You can imagine looking and seeing that and going, wow, okay, we're back, but... You know, and I expect their first inclination seemed to be to rebuild the temple, but also to rebuild their homes. But after a while, you sort of get content with the status quo, right? We just don't have time, the energy, the resources, perhaps, to rebuild the wall. The next picture is a famous wall, one that is found in the British Isles, built between the southern part of the main island and Scotland, would be called Hadrian's Wall. There, just a little, trivia thing. It's teachers asking these questions. To see. This is part of Hadrian's Wall, and you can see what happens. Hadrian's Wall was built by the Romans. Emperor Hadrian, well, he was a general at the time, but they built the wall to keep they couldn't get the Celts under control. I'm from Scotland and sort of have some Celtic background and just wild and unmanageable people, and so the Romans couldn't bring them under control, so you might as well build a wall to keep them out, right? And they built this particular wall, but you can see when a wall's got a hole in it, isn't quite as effective as you would like it to keep out the riffraff, right? So this is Hadrian's Wall in that northern part of England. The next picture is just to give you a bit of an idea. This is the modern city of Jerusalem. I put this picture on here just to give you an idea that, the city is a whole lot bigger than what it used to be. You can see some walls here. You can see the Temple Mount and the Dome on the Rock, a sacred site for Muslims. You can see the main part of the modern city of Jerusalem in the background, but you can see the walls here. And those walls were built during the early 1000s by the Crusaders. This is not the ancient wall, but it still gives a picture of the ancient city. You can see in the far right side there, sort of on the upper half, you can see, again, the old wall going around the city. The next picture gives you it's a tower. This tower is called the David Tower. You can see, though, that the walls, it's important for the walls, difficult for an enemy to overcome that when you surround your city with a wall. And Nehemiah realized that without the wall, then the city would lack protection. It would also lack a sense of identity. It's incomplete, right? They represent the status of the city. When you have a city that, has got a solid wall around it, it gives a sense of power and security. The gates are important because it also talks about access, both given and refused, right? You get the gates and there, you close the gate, you lock the doors, nobody comes in, is the idea. But then you open it and you welcome people in. And to Nehemiah, the broken walls and the gates of Jerusalem, those things represented a reproach to God. In chapter 2, verse 17, it was read, it's a reproach to God. It's an insult to God. The people mock God who live around the city because, you know, if this God is so powerful, why, and if he truly loves his people, why do his city walls lie in ruins? Why are the gates burned and shattered? If God is so good. And so Nehemiah takes it upon himself to inspect the walls as it was read to us, and then determine what needs to be done. And you notice at the very end of that particular passage, if you have your Bibles open there to Nehemiah chapter 2 and chapter 3, the people replied after Nehemiah says in verse 17, "Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace." Now, he says that we will no longer be in disgrace, but he also is inferring that God, as far as how God is perceived by other people, will not be disgraced. And I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me, and that's going back into chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. And look at the people's response. They replied, "Let us start rebuilding," so that they began this good work. A job needed to be done, and the people are saying, "Yes, let's do it." Warren Wiersbe, when it comes to talking about the work of the Lord, he says, "When it comes to the work of the Lord, there is no place for spectators or self-appointed critics, but there is always room for workers." Now, I'm not going to point fingers. I don't know you well enough, and I wouldn't point fingers anyway. But, you know, when you get a group of people that come together and proclaim to be part of a community, there's always going to be some, right? There's going to be some who, you know, "I really don't have time for that. It's not my bag. I don't really want to do this. You know, I'm not gifted that way." So, you know, they'll come and we'll come and we'll participate, but we won't get involved. And then there's those who feel that somehow it's their responsibility to sort of to keep an eye on things, to rate things. Dare I say, even, you know, the self-appointed critics. Those who suggest, you know, maybe my job is to make sure everybody stays in line and does it right. Wiersbe says, "There is no place for such people, but there's always room for workers." You see, those who had returned had become accustomed to the walls lying in ruins. Right? They got used to it. There was no motivation on their part. They were content. As long as their home, they had a roof over their head and they had food in their bellies and clothes on their back, everything's fine. Their own agenda is taken care of. The status quo, right? The status quo is that while they may be surrounded by enemies, they're surviving and everything's fine. They'll stay over there. They don't bother us. We won't bother them. But Nehemiah saw otherwise. He wasn't content with the status quo. He was concerned for God's reputation. He was obviously concerned, I think, in some respects, for the safety and security of God's people. He was inspired. I mean, understand, he was 1,000 miles away. Well, 2,000 miles away. I still do miles, by the way. It's just me. It's my age. But, you know, he heard the things. He heard what was going on. And he was, you know, he took it upon himself. I think he's inspired by God to this. But his story inspires people. Right? The people respond and say, "Yes, let us do this." And then we get to chapter 3. And we begin to see, and chapter 3 is simply a record of the building of the wall. But as I read chapter 3, I always wondered, why is it that, I don't know whether it's Ezra is recording this or whether Nehemiah is recording it. It sounds like it's in the first person, but it might be Ezra. It doesn't matter. In chapter 3, why is there this documentation, a very detailed documentation of all the people and what they did in the rebuilding of the wall? All 32 verses does that. Why not just say that the wall was rebuilt in 52 days by a whole bunch of people that got involved? And I thought, maybe there's a point to this. So I started to read through it. I wanted to share with you a bunch of lessons that I picked up. And I think it's important for us to think of this in the context of the fact that this is, you know, we're beginning of something new, right? It's a new year. There's things that are happening in this church, things that are happening in the church in Prince George, and all sorts of different ministries are starting up. YFC is starting up. I got an open house coming up, right, on the 6th. So why does he do this? And so I pulled out a bunch of lessons here, and it's not an exhaustive list, although there's quite a few, but I wanted to share with you some of the lessons I pulled out just by reading through this particular chapter, and you may get some others. The first one comes right in verse 1. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated to set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated and as far as the Tower of Hananiah. And what struck me here is that Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests, and I thought, why start here? What a great example. Why not start here? This is the high priest, right? And the impression would be the high priest would give the orders and the others would then carry out the task. But no, it says the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. So the first lesson that comes to me is that leaders lead by example. They don't just simply tell people what to do, but they get their hands dirty. They're not afraid to do that. They're not too proud. Their position is not too high and mighty to get involved. I think that's an important lesson, I mean, for those of you who are in positions of responsibility and leadership. Don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. The second thing that comes out of this is that they dedicated it. What do they dedicate? They dedicated it to what? To the Lord. And first and foremost, I think this is why Nehemiah or Ezra, whoever's writing this, puts this out there, is because this is God's work. This is the Lord's work that we're doing. And that's one thing I think we need to remember. We can get so caught up in our own individual programs and responsibilities, and we lose sight of the bigger picture that this is the Lord's work that we're doing. We're invited into that. You're invited into that. The second one comes up, and as a matter of fact, it's one that I just pulled out this morning, to be honest with you, as I was going through it, and I went, oh, yeah, here's another one. So I've actually a little bit longer. In verse 3 and then verse 12, it says, the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of, I didn't take time to figure out how to pronounce this, so I'm going to just probably butcher it. I don't know Hebrew well enough, but Hassanah, I'll do that. They put its beams, and they built its beams and put its doors and beams in place. Shalom, son of Holohesh, ruler of the half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. And the two things that jump out to me here is that the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons, and the section there was repaired with the help of his daughters. It's a family affair. It's not just mom and dad. There's a place for anybody in every age to get involved. And notice, I mean, obviously, this is pretty significant, isn't it? That it's the daughters, I think it stands out, it jumps out to me, that it's daughters. Understand the context historically. This isn't women's work historically, right? This is for men to do. Now, dare I say that in our modern era, let's flip this around. One of the things I've noticed most when it comes to Sunday school and Christian education, especially as it comes with kids, the majority, the overwhelming majority of people that get involved are women. I'm going, where are the men stepping up into that role? Where are the men that give that role model thing for the kids? I'm not looking to be condemning, I'm just making an observation. They even look at Cedars Christian School. I can count on one hand the number of men that are on staff and teaching at Cedars. 1, 2, 3 of us in high school. Yeah, 5. And that's leaving out administration. There's 5. Now, that's neither here nor there, but I also noticed that in the context of Sunday school with kids, right? Most of the Sunday school teachers are women. Now, that's a reverse context of what we're doing here, But see, I think it's suggesting that, you know what, it's not just guys who are getting their hands dirty and, you know, and mortar and brick and stone and building. Something that daughters helped us as well. There's a place for families, everybody in the family. Verse 5 says, the next section was prepared by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. And the translation is supervisors could be also translated as lord or governor. When I looked it up. One of the sad realities is that when it comes to the work of the Lord, there are those who somehow feel that certain work is beneath them. I'll just leave it at that. It's just a reality. It's an observation. Obviously, the challenge is that there's no work. Notice Eliashib, the high priest, and the priest got involved, right? And you'll see in other passages, other verses here, if you read through chapter 3, you'll see other leaders get involved. So why the nobles? I don't know. But it's interesting to me that while the leaders choose not to, the men of Tekoa do get involved, right? Just because their nobles don't doesn't mean that they don't. Why do they do it? They do it because it's the right thing to do. It's a job that needs to be done. You know, those up here say, no, that's beneath me. But those down here say, no, its job needs to be done. Just because they don't do it doesn't mean I can't or I shouldn't. Another lesson. Oh, I forgot to put the reference on this one here. It says, next to them, repairs are made by men from Gibeon and Mizpah. Melatiah of Gibeon and Jaden of Maranoth, places under the authority of the governor of Trans-Euphrates. Little aside here. Well, that's, I think, verse 7. Is that correct? Yes, verse 7. Just a little aside. Jaden, this is one of my inspirations for the naming of one of our sons. Just in the middle of the book of Nehemiah, this name jumped out at me. And it jumped out at me now for a couple of things. First of all, if you know the story of Gibeon and the Gibeonites from Joshua, they were the one group of people who lived in the land that deceived Joshua and the Israelites. And they were not destroyed or expelled from the land. They deceived them, and they created a treaty with them. And Joshua and the leadership, instead of allowing other enemies of the Gibeonites now to wipe them out, they come to their defense. But they're compelled for the rest of their existence in Jerusalem or Israel to be cupbearers, water bearers, and wood choppers. That was their fate of their people. But it's fascinating to me that these people, who were in essence slaves as a people to the Israelites for the rest of their existence, got involved in building the wall. And then these others, who were not Jewish by birth, they're under the authority of the governor of the Trans-Euphrates. They may be people who were colonists, if you will, who were from the Persian Empire, settled in there. They got involved. It's not just a Jewish thing here. But it was something that everybody are welcome to help who are willing to do so. Gibeonites and those places under the authority of the governor of the Trans-Euphrates. The same thing in this context here. Anyone and everyone are welcomed to participate in the Lord's work. Next, verse 8. Uzziah, son of Hariah, one of the goldsmiths repaired the next section, and Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. And what jumps out to me here in this particular verse as I'm reading it is notice the occupations of these men. One of the goldsmiths and perfume makers. Goldsmiths and perfume makers. They are not bricklayers and construction people. I expect they have soft hands, especially dealing with fine things like goldsmiths, right? Yeah, you might be able to hammer, but you're dealing with fine work. You see, you don't have to be highly skilled to help out. All you need to do is be willing to help out. You don't have to have the skills. Somebody will teach you that. Somebody will show you how to lay a stone properly. Somebody will show you how to put the mortar in properly, to mix it properly, get the right consistency. You can be taught how to do the things. You don't have to be skilled at the front end in order to do that. That was my first experience when I went up and was invited to teach at Peace River Bible Institute. I had just finished my master's studies at Providence Seminary in southern Manitoba. I was looking for a job in student life at a college, doing a lot of what I'm doing at Cedars now. And as I started to talk to, I met the academic dean and the president at the time, and they wanted my resume, and I said, oh, okay, and I gave them a resume. I was excited about that. And they invited us to come out there to teach there, and I said, listen, I don't have a degree in teaching. And they said, that's okay. Said, we can teach you how to teach, but we can't teach you what you bring, the mentality, the philosophy, the motivation that you have to build into the lives of students. That was what I had done for 9 years back in Toronto. That's what my training had been at the seminary. That's where I was going. And they said, but, you know, you have a passion to want to see people grow in their faith. We can teach you how to teach. We can teach you how to lay rocks and brick and mix mortar and put it in properly. We can teach you how to build a wall. All you need to do is be willing to get involved. The second thing that comes out of this one for me is you may be asked to do things outside of your comfort zone. Right? You may be asked to do things outside of your comfort zone. Goldsmiths and perfume makers, those guys were comfortable doing that. But in order to see this wall built, their hearts were in the place to want to see the Lord's work done, and they were willing to do it. Yeah, it's outside of their comfort zone. There's nothing more intimidating than walking into a class of grade 10 high school students who are just on the cusp of turning into young adults with a certain level of, I don't know how to define it, bordering on arrogance, but a sense of confidence that may or not be well placed. And you walk into that, and it's like, wow, it's intimidating. I'm looking at Brooklyn there because she was in the grade 10 class last year. It's intimidating walking. I was good in the college setting because I had all these students who were eager to want to learn about God in a Bible college setting. It was wonderful. But then you move into a high school setting, and not only do they may not want to be in your class, but they have to take it, but they don't even want to be at school. That's a tough thing to be a teacher when you got people who don't want to be there. And it becomes a little intimidating after a while, and it becomes draining. My comfort zone was the college setting. I liked that. And but teaching in the high school, you know, it's something I needed to learn. I need to learn all the different nuances of aspects of and especially in that particular setting. It took some time. And it's been just a joy to be part of it. I wasn't highly skilled in those areas. It was outside my comfort zone somewhat, but it's been a delight to be there. And hopefully some of you, as you start thinking, and maybe you're going to be asked to be involved in different aspects of ministry at this place, and you're going, you know what, I don't have any experience or any background in that. That's okay. Somebody sees something in you. And maybe you feel the presence of God in your life just prompting you, the Spirit, just to get up and to get involved. The needs will be expressed, and maybe you'll just feel a little prompting. I want to share with you a time when that happened with me, and quite interesting enough. How many of you remember, I don't think we do it much anymore, missions conferences that churches held? Remember missions conferences? Anybody? Wow, I really date myself. A few of us do. Good. Okay, so the missionary comes in, and for a whole week, you know, you've got stuff from one Sunday to one Sunday, and they're sharing, missionaries are sharing about their experiences. They're showing slides and movies and showing artifacts and just telling you about the work and encouraging you to think about going beyond the boundaries of your own church or your own country and think about doing missionary work elsewhere. And I remember sitting there, and the preacher's over there, and I was right over there, about the third row back, on wooden pews, just like this. Missionary is sharing his thing, and you know, and I'm hearing in my head, blah, 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 right? Heard this before, blah, 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 blah. And then he goes and he issues a challenge and a call. You know, if God is prompting you to get up and to step out and get involved and do the work of the Lord wherever he calls you, I want you to come forward and dedicate your life to doing that. And my wife's sitting over here right now because she knows this story. We weren't married yet. I don't think we were together. And I'm sitting there and I'm just hearing the blah, blah, blah. And then I hear this. And all of a sudden, I feel this overwhelming compulsion to get out of my seat. And I'm going, what is happening? I'm not going anywhere. I'm really good where I am right now. I'm good here. And I'm feeling, get up and go. I'm going, no. Get up and go. No. I have this battle going on in my head, right? And I'm going, where is this coming from? I felt like Jim Carrey as the Grinch in the live-action Grinch movie, for those of you that have seen the movie. He starts crying. He goes, what is happening to me? He's never tried before, right? His heart is beating, and he's crying, and he doesn't understand what's happening. I don't know what's understanding what's happening to me. But I feel I have to get up because this is not going to, he's not going to stop saying anything, and I'm not going to feel comfortable unless I get up and do this. So I get up out of my seat, and I come up here, and I join a few other people up the front. And I sensed it was the call of God upon my life to simply get involved in full-time ministry service, wherever that leads. I walk back to my seat, and sitting right behind me is Mrs. Jean Sherbarth. She loved to sing in special music at church, and she's smiling. I'm looking at her, why are you smiling at me? The moment she'd been praying for me that whole time, she'd been praying, and I'm getting goosebumps right now, because she had been praying that I would get up and dedicate my life to serving God wherever that would take us. And we've been in southern Ontario, we've been to southern Manitoba, we've been to northern Alberta, and we're here in north central BC, doing whatever God is leading us to do. And you may feel that upon your heart sometime during this year, and I encourage you to respond to it. You may not be highly skilled, you may be outside your comfort zone, but God may lay that burden upon your heart to get involved. Last couple of lessons. The Valley Gate was prepared by Hanan and the residents of Zenoa. They built it, rebuilt it, and put its doors and bars and bolts in place. They also repaired 500 yards of the wall as far as the Dung Gate, verse 13. One of the things that strikes me in this particular lesson that gets me is that some repair small parts, but some are motivated to go above and beyond what is asked or expected. And I think we just need to rejoice in that. You know those people, right? Those who do a whole lot more. And I think that's wonderful. But we also have to understand it doesn't diminish the importance of the help that everybody brings. Whether you replace simply some gates and some doors and bolts and put those in place, or you do 500 more yards of the wall. Some do a little, some do a lot, but all of it is part of the whole work. And then above the horse gate, two more lessons. Above the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. Next to them, Zadok, son of Imer, made repairs outside, opposite his house. I think it's really interesting to me that those who have a vested interest in something will be highly motivated. Some of you might have grandchildren. Some of you might have children. I think you have a vested interest in terms of being involved in the ministry, right? Not to sleep, but you got a vested interest. You got kids in Sunday school or grandkids in Sunday school or youth group or whatever. I bet you could be highly motivated to get involved, to be able to see and be part of that ministry to those kids. There may be other areas in which you're highly motivated, but those with a vested interest. The vested interest here, obviously, is to finish the piece of wall right where my house is. my house is on the other side of the wall. I better finish that right there because now at least I know that section, it's repaired. And obviously your neighbor hopefully does theirs. I mean, the whole idea that they were repairing pieces of the wall right where the houses were. Why? Because they wanted to protect their own family and their own property. The next slide shows the picture of the finished wall. And this is the prison wall of the old city. But this is the city in Nehemiah's time, right here, this dark line. I don't know how many yards it is, how long this particular wall was. I could have researched that a little bit more. It's much smaller than the city that the wall that you would see today around the old city. But what struck me about this is this wall was built in 52 days. That suggests to me there was a lot of people that got involved to do the work of the Lord. It would be fascinating to me if there was just one person who didn't do their job. Well, somebody else would have to pick it up, right? But everybody got involved with it, and the wall was completed in 52 days in the midst of the opposition. If you know the story, the rest of the book, there's opposition to the building of the wall. The people who want to see they don't want to see the Jewish people strengthened and revived. There was opposition to it, but in the midst of the opposition, in the midst of the danger that was there, they got it built in 52 days. The biggest lesson that I get out of this is the last one. And that is that one for all and all for one and one for all, it's important to acknowledge that everyone who helps out, regardless of the amount or significance of their contribution. I think it's incumbent upon churches and leadership to make sure that everybody who gets involved is recognized and acknowledged and thanked, regardless of how much they get involved. I find it fascinating that there's a church in Quesnel that I was asked to speak at a while ago this particular weekend, and they do a celebration banquet at the beginning of the new year, and they invite everybody who has volunteered to help out, and they have a banquet to celebrate that at the front of their year. Not at the end, saying job well done. They'd celebrate it at the front of the year. And they named them all. Took a long time. They named them all. I think that's what Nehemiah does here in chapter 3. He names everyone who got involved, regardless of how much they did, whether it was just the section in front of their house, or whether it was 500 extra yards of the wall. But they did a little or they did a lot. I think it's important for us, when you get involved in ministry, to thank and acknowledge those who get involved. I don't know how you do what you do here. And it's an encouragement. And maybe one of the things that we can do collectively as individuals is to thank those people who get involved on a weekly, daily basis. Just thank them. You don't have to write it down. You don't have to have a banquet necessarily. But just thank them as a means to encourage them and to acknowledge what they've gone and done has been the Lord's work. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that your work is your work and that you call each and every one of us to get involved in some way. And I pray, Father, that if your Spirit is moving in the hearts of people here today, to find a way in which they can take part in your work here, I pray that they would respond to that. And Lord, I pray also that as we look around us on a weekly, monthly, the annual basis, that we will take the time to acknowledge those who have stepped up and stepped into whatever role you've called them to. And Lord, I pray that we'd never lose sight that while it's people that you're using, that ultimately it's your work that's being done to your glory and to your honor. In Jesus' name, amen.